It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, right back at you, whether you were gone or not. I was, and so this is a new episode. I am Dr. Dan. I am a retired professor, escaped professor. I didn't retire. They just kicked me out. I'm a late night comedy writer and rhetorician. I started Rhetoric Warriors to try to, kind of rile up the world a little bit, maybe teach people some skills about creating messages and dealing with messages that they don't have. America, you're unprepared for sophisticated messaging, and it's killing you. Why don't you get on your game? That's what this is about. I do three things on the podcast. I talk to comedians and comedy pros, and that's going to be today. One of my favorite people in Hollywood is going to talk to us today. I also bring people on that I think need to be converted. That's usually the right, because they worry me. I think they've slipped off the rails of democracy. So I try to move their train engine back onto the rails. And finally, I talk to persuasion pros, and that's a little bit of this guy today too, and academics, more rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast you will hear today. I promise you. So my guest today, a good buddy of mine, we work together at Best Dan Sports Show. He's been in Hollywood for a long time, and I kind of vaguely know his story. I know a lot of his kind of personal story, but his professional story, I know a little bit of it, and we're going to talk about it today. Everybody welcome from Fox. He runs Fox, him and Rupert.
Yeah.
This is the nicest guy at Fox. I promise that. Brian Kahn.
Hello, Dan. So nice to see you. My gosh, you're a beauty in that little screen box. I love you. How are you, man?
Look at that. See, you are the nicest guy at Fox, right? You have to be.
You know what? There's a lot of great people at Fox. And I'm not just saying that because I've worked there for, 18 years. I mean, as you mentioned, Best Damn Sports Show, I was on that show for 4.5 years. What we did on it, we were writer producers on it. We came up with this comedy sketches. We wrote jokes for Tom Arnold. And we did that until they fired us. I mean, Jerry, we'll get into our fearless leader in practice, but we were the last standout comedy writers, Jerry Berzigian and myself. And Dan came in. And what is your story there in Best Dan? How did you get the job and how long were you there for?
So I got that job. That was my first job in Hollywood. Like my first job writing for a Hollywood type was writing for Yakov Smirnoff. That a buddy of mine hooked me up with. But Best Damn, Rich Williams and I knew each other from stand-up, and I was going down the improv every Thursday night and telling everybody at the bar that I wanted a writing job. And he heard this and said, hey, you want to try to get a 2-day tryout on Best Damn Sports? We can't hire you because we can't handle another white guy on the payroll. But if you want, I'll get your stuff to the head writer. And I'm like, cool. And so I sent the head writer my stuff that night, Jerry Berzigian. He called me 20 minutes later. It's like, why don't you come in tomorrow morning? And that was the beginning of my, a year and a half at Best Damn Sports Show, where I was never officially hired. Because they didn't.
You never got the benefits. You never got the health care. You never got the 401k contributions, the pension. You got none of that. Those perks.
I guess I didn't. now that I think about it. Yeah, it was very cheap. I think I was like $850 a week and nothing else.
Gotcha. Well, the experience is invaluable, Daniel. That's what you got there. And it was
job. I loved that job.
It was so fun. I mean, it reminds me of like the back in the day, because, I'm so old, your show of shows where they actually, they came up with a concept. They wrote the concept. They rehearsed the concept. They had to do the wardrobe and makeup and so forth and perform it that same week. Although we did everything in one day.
One day.
We read the paper. We read the stories, what was taught that day. And then we came up with our comedy sketches and we wrote our one-liners for Tom Arnold.
Yeah. And we got it past Jerry Berzigian, who wanted to turn it into War and Peace, the sketch. And to grammarianize every single thing. I used to call him the niggler. Make sure you pronounce that correctly. He would niggle every single word.
Yeah.
And you'd have to push it past him like, Jerry, it's just jokes, dude. It's just jokes.
No, verbosity is certainly is a strong suit. And the problem with that show, and look, I love working on that show. It was work. They're great. There were stand-ups like yourself. There were stand-ups like Bob Oshak and Brian Keith Etheridge, and you mentioned Rich Williams. And then we had more on the production side. I came from sitcoms. Josh David came from sitcoms. Jerry, of course, he's the veteran of sitcom writing himself with the Jeffersons and so forth. In fact, Jerry gave me one of my first writing jobs in Hollywood as a sitcom writer, which we could table that for later. But so we had six really strong comedy minds who had to funnel the comedy to non-comedy brains. The sports guys they were judge, jury, and executioner of all of our stuff. So that was, that was the challenge every week. So then you have to, okay, so now you as a writer, you have your instincts and your gut. This makes me laugh. This is funny because I've honed my craft. I listened to the craft. I studied the craft. I listen to comics. I know it all. So now how can I funnel that to the non-comedy mind and package it for him so he will buy into it? That was a lot of our job.
Oh, it was fascinating. I used to describe it as, hey, I don't have a sense of humor, so I'm going to retain line item veto over every punchline and joke. I'm like, hey, that's a great idea. You've really thought this through.
Yeah, for sure. And you were so fun to be on staff with because, you're not an easy laugh, Dan French. if you're sitting there and we're saying, if we say a line, we're looking at Dan, did the corner of his mouth go up? Did I hear an exhale and his vocal cord make a vibration of a laugh? It's in. Let's move on.
It's a stand-up thing. Like once you do stand-up for 20 years, you've heard all the jokes. So like your bar just keeps kind of floating upward, whether you want it to or not. So yeah, that's part of it.
One Dan French punchline that just stayed in my mind till this day. And it's been how many years? It's been over 20 years since that Sam. And that punchline, I don't remember the joke, but it was a two-word punchline that was painted ladies. Painted ladies. No one was writing like that on our staff. Like, painted ladies. I guess you're doing some. Maybe there was an NFL player got in trouble with a hooker or whatever.
No.
I don't know.
Okay, I know exactly what this was. This was the. Okay. I think it was the first sketch, the first full sketch I got on the show, and it was when we had a referee, a buddy of yours, come in and do the confessional where Oshak was the priest, and this guy played a referee who had screwed up a pass interference call in the San Francisco Green Bay playoff game the weekend before that everybody was upset about. And he was confessing to Oshak. And one of the things he said was, I spent Christmas Eve dallying with painted ladies in a house of ill repute. And, great. Yeah, and then he admitted he blew the call and, Oshak went through the confessional to attack him.
But that's a very clever, funny piece of writing there on a show that was more like, get hit in the nuts and you're dumb shit and you're get smacked on the head. You got crook and all your sports guys and no knock on them, but they're professional sports guys. And we're introducing some comedy to them. And you think sports and comedy is a great combination. And it was. We hit many strides on that show. I'm really proud of that show.
If they hadn't gutted that show, like with taking out a lot of the comedy and expanding it to 2 hours a day and all that, it worked. That show just worked.
Yeah. It was a lot of it was like, okay, this is what you have. You have a milk bottle, a tuning fork, and a thimble. Make a comedy bit. And so you are forced into this. I'm handcuffed to a radiator and I have to come up with something. And that, I love that. I mean, that kind of training gets you into the, okay, now since I know what I have, I could MacGyver this sketch and I can make it whatever it is. I remember one time, one of my lowlights on Best Day, which was, we were doing a bit with, I think it was, who was the guy on from Animal House? He was Tim Matheson was a guest on the show. And I think one of our ideas, I don't know if you were on staff at this time, but one of our ideas we have the audition tapes for actual roles from of the actual guys in Animal House.
Yeah, great.
Let's
roll it. Great concept. Yeah. Here we go. Yeah.
Fun concept. We'll have John Crook come out and he will do an otter or an ox line and so forth. And who was Belushi's character?
I forget the name. Bluto.
Bluto. Okay. Perfect. Was that Popeye's friend? The same.
I think it's the same guy.
So, So I was standing next to Tom, and we were doing this. We were doing the auditions on the set. It was before the show taped, and we were just getting him in all in the can. And Tom was not really comfortable with the concept. And the joke was he was going to put like whipped cream in his mouth, and then do, look, I'm a zit, like Bluto right. did. So that was his audition. And he couldn't get his head around it or didn't want to do it. And so he said, "Help me out here. Help me. I need something else." So I'm like, "Oh, okay." I'm just off camera, and I'm the copy's funny, but okay, let's think of something. And they're like, "We're rolling. Keep going." And so he's out, and he leaned into me, and he said to me very quietly, just between the two of us, the whole crew's there. He said, "You're killing me. You're killing me." Like, it's all me. I'm ruining his career. I'm making it all horrible for him. I'm killing him. All right. Anyways, he did it. It was funny, and that was that. But
yeah, that was his particular thing of always being put upon by having to work for his $3 million a year or whatever it was. I have so many great memories and stories from that show, but like that one, I remember, you know, they get to the point where they all felt like they were working too hard for their money, and they didn't want to do more than just sort of sit on set and talk about sports. So you give them a bit and things, and they'd be like, "Nah." I remember Michael Irvin, who was really talented. That guy could act. If he'd have wanted to move into acting had to do something with it, he actually could have. But we had written a sketch for him, and I went looking for him to see if he wanted to do it. And I came around the corner, and he saw me, and he's like, "Oh no, motherfucker." And he took off running the other direction. And I'm like, "I'm not going to chase Michael Irvin, one of the fastest human beings on the planet, to make him do comedy."
That's a chase I'd love to see. And I'm sorry it didn't happen. That's crazy. I remember Brian Cox. You know, he's a huge man, very menacing. I mean, I don't know what his, I think it's, I don't know if he's played offense or defense for what team. By the way, I kind of
linebacker for the Bears. Brian
okay,
Cox,
there you go. Yeah, he was huge. And I once was pitching him in the wardrobe room. I said, "So here's the idea for the sketch, and this is what you're gonna do." And he looked at me as if I was asking him to do something really offensive. And I said, "Don't do it, Brian. I mean, I have no skin in the game. If you don't want to do it, I don't want to offend you by these non-offensive lines, but you're taking the offense, so let's go with you." And so he forget about it. And then VG calmed down. He said, "All right, let me take a look at it." And I don't even remember the bit, but he eventually did it. But, you know, there was a lot of giving. "Oh, here come the comedy guys. I'm out of here."
Well, athletes aren't used to being silly on purpose. Like they're used to being loved and, you know, everybody just constantly complimenting them for everything they do, but they're not used to moving into another world where, "Oh my God, something's on the line here. I might fail." And it's a really interesting psychology to watch them try to go through that.
And some guys can embrace, like, for that. I think John Kruk was a good partner, and John Sally, maybe it's the name John, but John Sally was very, we did a bit where I think there was a new, the Bond movie coming out. And we did a thing where it's like, 007 footer, and we had John Sally play Bond trying to get into a sports car that's the size of a Tonka truck, and he's 7 foot tall, and his struggle to get inside the car was the trailer for his Bond movie. It was hilarious that he was a very good sport.
Yeah, I love those. Like, Kruk was amazing to me. Like, he was such a comic character. He hated the fact that he was having to do comedy, I think, but like, I always thought the tension between him and Tom Arnold was actually sitcom quality. Like, you could have lifted those two dudes out, put them as neighbors in a sitcom, and it would have just worked, because it was so much fun to write in shots back and forth for those guys.
Yeah.
You know,
were you there for the time we did a roast for the show?
Yeah. Yeah.
We did, I think it was a John Kruk roast. And so writing jokes for, or they were roasting Tom, I forget which direction it was going, but they were just like, "Bring it on." They were thirsty for these one-liners to go after each other. And that was their relationship that you're saying. It was totally, it was Abbott Costello. It was just fighting, but they're good friends.
Well, and at the time Drew Carey's show was on, and that show was literally just that between him and the woman on that show. I can't remember her name, but she was really good at taking jokes and then, you know, hitting him back. And it was just, you know, barb, zinger, zinger, zinger. And that, I love that format, man. I love writing zingers like that.
Absolutely. Which made during for your viewers out there, how our day struck came about. We come up with a sketch or two for that day. We then write a segment called Things You Wouldn't Say. At the end of the show, these are like insult jokes to the target of the day in sports. Somebody who did something stupid on the field or embarrassed themselves or lost the game, we would take them as our bullseye. And then the other thing we did, we just gave however many segments there are in a show, let's say there's six, each segment is broken down. The first one, we're talking NFL. Second, we're talking baseball. Third, we're talking gymnastics. Third is world soccer, and then NASCAR. So let's say that those are the topics. We then armed Tom with 10 jokes per category, and just to have him just be able to look at his cheat sheet and then whip it off if rip it out if it's appropriate. And a lot of the times we actually, if Kruk sitting there, some of it was just a simple, easy bag of tricks. Make it a Kruk joke.
Yeah, well, and that tension between sports guys and guys in general, they're always taking shots at each other. So the humor is perfectly in theme, it perfectly fine in the culture. And I remember when, Irvin liked to dress up. He liked to come in with something that's going to get attention. And he walked in once in sort of purple satin. It looked like pajamas. And, Tom Arnold called us between breaks and said, "Hey, I want to say something about Irvin's outfit." It's like, "Well, go ahead, man. You got our permission." He's like, "No, write me lines. I want lines." And we know you want lines.
That's right. During there was a moment in the show where they need our executive producer. I don't need to say his name, but he actually wanted to inject more comedy into the show, and he needed to have more life with it. And they were always in panic mode of things, we need to turn this around. We need more ratings. We need this and that. So I remember he said, "Con," and I think it was me and Josh, "come with me to the control booth." So we're standing behind him. He's at the desk and he has a microphone, and Josh and I were to whisper in his ear jokes that he could then whisper into the mic, and which goes into the ear. And so we did that a couple times, and then that went away. But we got a couple jokes on that way, live through his ear, through the mic, through his palm, to America.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I think I learned so much about fast production on that show. Like you said, show up in the morning, and sports is massive. You can talk about sports clearly. There's so many stations that are just sports. There's so much going on across the world in sports every day. So you're never going to run out of material. And there's always something crazy that happens every day. So you've got flashpoint stories. You've got all this stuff to work with. And then you just kind of, figure out from the way your show does it, what's allowed and what isn't allowed. Like, I remember Pete Rose bet on baseball. He finally admitted he bet on baseball. And we weren't allowed to do Pete Rose jokes because he was a friend of the producer. Do you remember this?
Right.
He's like,
yep.
I think we had him on the show. But we had to treat him like he was somehow royalty still, sports royalty, as opposed to, a sports villain.
Yeah, because we don't want to get a name for it. But we had a lot of talent bookers on the show who actually went out and reached out to all these huge stars. And we want that door to always remain open. So we want to make this a friendly fire environment and not really put people's feet to the fire. And the beautiful thing about this show also, we got major celebrities. A lot of actors and comics want to come on and talk sports too. What a great thing to get off their career. And we don't have to talk about what's going on the set and so forth. The character I'm playing, we could talk my favorite team, the Cowboys.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. No, it's a big thing. We had Norm on quite a bit.
We had Norm.
That was so much fun to watch Norm MacDonald just talking sports or gambling or whatever he wanted to talk about.
Yeah. I remember we actually had he was guest hosting for a week, and he was sitting in the chair. He was coming in every day, so we were giving him jokes. And he was such a great guy, and he loved to take a joke and turn it inside out. And he took all of our lines and he made it his own by inverting it, exposing it, and then planting it in a different way. And it's like, I see my joke in there somewhere. But he made it better, and he made it in his voice. And that's the thing, when you're working with comics, you have to really honor who they are, and they know the material the best. You can just give them the areas and go from there.
Didn't you play basketball with him? Weren't you guys in a pickup game with him on a
regular
basis?
Yeah, for about a year.
Something?
It was, believe it or not, how it all came about, I knew Cato Kalin, the famous Cato Kalin from the OJ trial. How did I know him? Trying to think about how this happened. I think maybe he came for a pickup game anyway. So we were playing with Cato for many months, and he's a great guy. We really enjoyed Cato. fact, I hired him to do some stuff. In fact, he came to Best Damn. I hired him for a day on Best Damn to do some shtick with us, and he was a really great sport. But he was very good friends with Norm Macdonald. That was a strange coupling. So Cato brought Norm to a couple of the games at Fairfax High School in Hollywood, and Norm played with us for about a year. And it was, once again, it was just great. He was very chill, liked to play with the guys, just hang out, be one of us.
It's funny how many people we brought through there, like Ken Chung. Is that how you say his name? Ken Chung?
Ken Chung.
Yes. He was our, I mean, we gave him some of his first acting jobs. He was terrible. I've always loved Ken. I thought he was a great stand-up, and he's a great dude. Gotta love that guy. But his acting chops, you know, it doesn't really have acting chops. He just kind of does a little same thing, you know, either does the I'm a hip-hop guy, which he does really well. Or, you know, he does that kind of little thing he does in The Hangover where whatever they give him, he does it well. But he was like, I remember we had him in a bit as Godzilla, like because they had brought in a Japanese player to the Yankees.
We were so offensive.
I don't know. It wasn't really offensive. It was kind of using Japanese pop culture within American pop culture. We didn't do it like
maybe
that.
Maybe this was then. I actually have worked with Ken recently at Fox. He's one of the judges and panelists of The Masked Singer. He's also the host of a show called I Can See Your Voice on Fox. And I love Ken. I think he's really funny and he's so talented. And he did us part of the things I do now. I'm sure we can dovetail into this some point. I do marketing and promotion now for Fox. I'm a creative director over at the network. And part of my job is to take a Fox show or Fox IP, intellectual property, and take a brand and try to find what's that bridge that comes and have them come together. Well, we did this thing where Scoob the movie, Scoob by Warner Brothers, just came out. They wanted to get in bed with The Masked Singer, and who wouldn't? Because the number one show on television. And Ken Jeong was the voice of Dynamite in Scoob the movie. So the concept was, I wrote, produced, and creative directed this concept where we had, it was going to a commercial break from show, and then we come up on Ken at behind his panelist desk, and he's like between breaks, like, oh, it's kind of behind the scenes feel right now. And then all of a sudden the lights go down, and up starts another musical number, and a club sandwich comes on stage and starts singing. And it's like, what's going on? It's like, and the audience is getting into it. And eventually the club sandwich takes off its olive and Scooby's head pops out. And it's basically a promotion for the movie Scoob in the show. And people are, is this real? What's going on? And then eventually Ken takes off his head and reveals it's Dynamite. So that was a really great integration. I won a couple of awards with that.
All right, Brian Kahn winning the awards.
Thank you, Ken Jeong, for once again, as a comic, a funny guy,
taking the
words and making it his own. So during the production of this, I actually went up to Ken and said, Ken, you don't remember me, I guarantee it, but I worked on sports, Best on Sports Show, and I once asked you to be Yao Ming in a sketch. And he went, oh yeah, I remember that. It was the same day, the day after Kobe Bryant died. And so Ken was devastated. So we didn't have the kind of playful back and forth as I wanted, because it was like, remember that day? But yeah, Ken was one of our early go-tos.
Yeah, it was fascinating. Like you said, trying to take, you know, a marshmallow, a piece of barbed wire, and, you know, some penny that you found on the ground, and be like, ah, we got it. The sketch.
Exactly.
We're like, well, you got $30, you know, so... And we brought in non-union talent to act, and you always had great connections with like real actors who would come in and do stuff.
That's right.
For nothing.
That's right. And also, I was in a couple hundred sketches myself, and if I remember, I mean, because I just put myself in, I have a little performance in me. I actually have this kind of itch I'm slowly scratching. I'm doing a web series. Maybe we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
But there was a moment that we forced you on camera once, and you were not happy with it.
I just wasn't good at it.
But you don't have to be good at this one. That we wrote it once again. Who is the comic? How can we write for Dan French? And this was the idea. I don't know if you remember it. So for some reason, Leo DiCaprio was in the news that week or that day. And we had Tom Arnold saying, hey, we got Leonardo DiCaprio on the show. Oh, he canceled? No, he didn't. He's right here. And it was you with a sign around your neck that said Leonardo DiCaprio, and Tom Arnold toured you around the lot and said, look, I got Leo DiCaprio. That was the spit that I remember you were in.
Yeah, I remember Oshak getting very frustrated with me once because he'd written me into a bit. And because I'm a bigger dude, he always, you know, they always threw me the kind of working class guy was my role on all these things. And so he had me in a wife beater or something and with a cigar. And I was just supposed to say, you missed the turlet again. I think that was my line. And I just, like, he kept going, just, he got so frustrated with me. I'm like, dude, I don't act.
Which is so surprising because, you know, comics are actors. And I know you don't really, I mean, you were pursuing comedy on stage for how many years?
Yeah, but that's monologue. That's, yeah, okay. I'm in control there. It's me. It's not, I mean, it's a little variation of me, but it's definitely me. I don't, my kids give me grief because every time I ever talk about them in my act, I do a Southern accent. They're like, we're not redneck. And that's the only character I can play. I grew up in Kentucky. I can play rednecks.
There you go. They're the typecast French. There you go.
Yeah, so that cost me money over the years. Like, I'd write a bit. I remember, where was I? I guess at the Late Late Show, and I wrote a bit. This was when Michael Jackson was still alive and going through his trial, and it was a bit about we're going to cut to Michael. Michael keeps calling in to talk to Craig Kilborn, you know, to tell him what's going on and where he's at, and I'm at a Chuck E. Cheese in Burbank. And I couldn't do the voice. So Ted Mulcairn did the voice. He did a really good Michael Jackson. And he got paid like $800 every time he did it because it was a network appearance. And I'm like, damn.
I know. They just, those opportunities. I mean, unfortunately, Best Damn was a non-union shop. So there were none of those opportunities, or else I would have made a killing at work doing all the sketches that I've done. Remember, we had Bob Saget guest hosted as many times, and working with Saget closely was incredible. And once again, him bringing his voice and working with these big comedy minds was just, it was a great experience. So fun.
Yeah. And the fact that, like you said, it was very non-threatening, it was sports. And so anybody would come on and do it. And even the sports guys, you know, I remember the day, remember the show we did? I'm sure you do. Where we brought in the greatest college running backs of all time. So we had Archie Griffin, Billy Sims, Herschel Walker, and Bo Jackson on the same set. I remember standing outside with these guys waiting for something and like, Bo Jackson and Herschel Walker are about my size. And I'm like, how are you this much better of an athlete than I am? And I'm like, these are two of the greatest athletes who've ever been on the planet here. And that was the day where they, you know, Bo Jackson brought his pies. Remember all that, right?
I don't.
Oh God, this is one of my favorite stories to tell about Best Damn. So they were sitting there, and Herschel Walker's insane and was just taking shots at Bo Jackson and everybody else the whole time, like trying to be the big, you know, stud on the set, even though, you know, these guys were as good or better than he was. And Bo Jackson was promoting pies. So he brought sweet potato pies for the entire crew, like 30 or 40 pies, and gave them out. So Herschel's giving him grief the whole time, and Bo's just an unassuming kind of guy, and he's like, whatever. And finally, at the end, Herschel goes, you know what? I've given Bo a hard time this whole show, but I want to say, and he picks up the pie, because you can tell what if it's a good pie or not by how heavy it is, and that's some heavy pie.
Please tell me Tom had a fun rebut to that.
I don't think he said anything, but I know Josh David loved that line, and we kept saying, if you'd pitch something wasn't a good pitch, you'd be like, that's some light pie, man. Get that light pie out of here.
That's great. That's great. I love that.
So many fun. Great stories like that, right?
From that Absolutely. Show. Oh, for sure. It was, and we had a lot of writers come and go on the show too. Like, you came and went, and there was a couple other stand-ups that came and went, and it was always great to inject some new energy in and some
how
new
did
voices.
You survive? How come you stayed? Like, how come?
Yeah. How about that?
What?
That's I know the guardrails of any position that I go into, and I know exactly where I can veer and not. And I just stay up. Dan, I'm incredibly talented. I'm just.
That's what I was.
We have to move on.
I was trying to say, if only I had your talent. No, I remember, like, I left the show because Fox had a policy of just cutting back every quarter. Like, that's one of the things that crippled the show, right? As long, they get rid of the comedy staff, they got rid of the comedy producers, and like finally it's like, hey, why isn't the show any funny anymore? Well, you know, you don't have any. But so I left because they were doing budget cuts. I remember going in that day and talking to whatever the guy's name was who ran it, and he's like, I've got to let you go. He goes, you're the last one hired, and that's just the easiest way for me to make this cut. And I'm like, you know, I might argue that you want to look around kind of at the staff and figure out, like, well, does it need this or does it need that? And show, and he's like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to actually curate the quality of what we can do. But
what have the things that I admire about you, Dan, and I'm going to put you on a little pedestal, is that your lack of, is your confidence. You always had an air of confidence about you, not much insecurity. And I, maybe it's because you're not Jewish, and that's maybe that
Jewish.
But you walk in and you don't necessarily have to kowtow, and you said, here's what I'm going to offer you. You take it, leave it. If you wanted me to leave it, okay, I'm gone. I know you had a wife and a kids back then, and I'm sure you had rent and a car payments. You all have all those things, but I did too. But that it frightened me that maybe I come from the mentality of the other shoe is always going to drop. So I got to make sure that those rails are always on there, that the shoe really doesn't drop, or I'm going to catch it. But you were like, how does Dan do it? He just goes and he's just very cool as a cucumber. And that's admirable in this business.
Well, I think your approach is perfectly valid. I don't ever advocate just walking in and causing trouble for no reason. That's Rich Williams, right? Rich brought me in, and then they fired him at the end of the week. He brought me in. And because Rich was a little mouthy, you know, Rich and edgy. And I can get mouthy and edgy if I want to, but it doesn't run me. Like, I'm not going to just cause trouble because I'm a troublemaker. But if somebody's doing something really stupid or doing something that's going to ruin things, I probably will speak up. You know, so I'm somewhere in the middle of you and Rich Williams. I try to be.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you also come from a discipline. Your discipline is academia, and there's a work ethic from that. I know you did stand-up comedy, but if you're stand-up comic straight, you may not have the kind of muscles that it takes to work in corporate America. It's Fox Sports, it's corporate America. I have, you know, going back to my history, it's, I don't know if you want to know.
No,
exactly.
I do. I'm curious.
I first started off as a, when I left film school, I was working in commercials down in San Diego, in San Diego State. But then I moved to LA and I got a job as a page at NBC. And back then, Johnny Carson was hosting the Tonight Show. I don't know if you know that kid. Anyway, so I was, exactly. So we have Carson, and we were giving tours of the audience of the studio.
Did you used to watch Carson, like, on set?
Oh, every day. And it's once again, like you're saying, you're sitting there looking at Herschel Walker and Bo Jackson. You want to listen to their stories. I get to watch Johnny off the side interview people, to work on his monologue, or he didn't work on his monologue. It was on Cards. He came out, read it, and sat down. But music, Bruce Springsteen, they come out and do rehearsals. It was just a great job.
That's amazing, actual, you know, in life experience of these mythic characters. Yeah.
Totally. And the studio on television is huge, but in real life, it's small. I was there when Carson was slowly handing the torch to Leno. So Jay was often coming in and guest hosting in 50-50.
And Leno was used to burn down comedy.
But to Jay, I was always a Letterman guy versus the Leno guy, my taste level. But Jay was the nicest man. He used to stop and talk to my tour groups. He was just a mensch. She was a really good guy. But from there, I had entree to the network of NBC, and I got a job as an assistant in development for NBC production. Back then, Brandon Tartikoff was the president. So he's a legend in television in his own right. During all this time, I wanted to write sitcoms, and I was honing my craft. I was getting scripts that were being made. I had somebody in comedy who would give me scripts to Cheers and Frasier and Dear John and Empty Nest and The Golden Girls and all these great shows that actually I was reading. And they're my treasure maps. And I go read them. It's, this is how it's done. This is how you actually not only type a script, but you could see the rhythms of a script and the arcs and the buttons of scenes and so forth. So I started writing my own specs as I sat in this assistant's job. But I wasn't getting really, I wanted to still get into comedy further and faster. So what better way to get a job on a sitcom? So I got a job. I angled my way to another NBC property called Amen, Neil Sherman Hemsley sitcom, you know, Mr. Jefferson. He actually was doing a show for 7 years called Amen. He played a deacon in a church. Clifton
he
Davis.
Did he still have his leisure suit?
I think so.
The wide lapels and the, oh my God.
Exactly.
He's such a great character.
Another nice man, boy, but he had a really tough ending of his life. That's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, that is a whole other podcast. The secrets behind Hollywood.
I know, right? So I was a writer's assistant on Amen. And for those of you who don't know what writer's assistant does, they do everything they have to deal with the script non-creatively. They type the script. They take the writer's notes. They take down writer's notes in the room when they're pitching. They're writing the jokes. They're writing jokes down. They're typing up the script. They're distributing the script. They're photocopying the scripts. They're collating the scripts. Once again, it's another great way of seeing how production works. And this is another step into getting closer.
Were you actually taking written notes back then? I guess you were, right? Because there weren't computers.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that job got me another job on what I'm so proud of as a writer's assistant on The Golden Girls. And that's where I met Jerry Berzichian. And that I was working with the Hall of Fame of writers on that show. I mean, the guys, Mitch Hurwitz, who went on to create Arrested Development, and Mark Cherry went on to do Desperate Housewives. Great, great writing staff. I was taking notes in that room as well, listening to how it works and so forth. So intimidated by this because these guys are freaking the Mount Rushmores of comedy writers on The Golden Girls. Also, with the stars of the show. I mean, to write for those ladies, the Mount Rushmore comedian.
Yeah,
on television.
For sure, yeah. That was back when there was not that much dilution in Hollywood talent, right? There weren't many shows on. And so you could put together an all-star staff like that, and it would stay together for a while.
That's right. That's right. With Thomas, who produced The Golden Girls, they did Empty Nest, the Richard Mulligan sitcom. They were on for like many seasons. They did Soap back in the day with Billy Crystal, if you remember that show. That was ahead of its time as well. So with Thomas was killing it. They had almost like three shows on in the top 10 back in the day, Golden Girls being one of them. And from there, I'm still writing scripts. As a writer speccing it out, I'm able to give my scripts to the writers on the show saying, hey, would you read this? They're looking at me as I'm trying to be nice with me, keeping the rails. I'm learning through corporate world how to make friends and so forth. And they look at me, well, first of all, I'm an assistant. I'm not threatening. I'm a nice guy. I'm not going to take away their job. Sure. So I'm Jerry Berzichian, really instrumental in my development. He didn't know he was my mentor, but he was my mentor. He read me. He gave me notes. A lot of other writers on that staff did the same. Kevin Abbott, very talented writer. He's gone on to do some big things. He just executive produced a Last Man Standing a couple seasons ago. And of course, Baxley Gamble, who actually were the head writers of the show at the time, and Richard Baxley became a very good friend of mine, and we're still friends. He hired me for my first writer's job after The Golden Girls. There was an NBC sitcom called Here and Now. It was starring Malcolm Jamal Warner. It was to be filmed, and we went to New York to do the show. Bill Cosby was my boss. That guy went on to such great things as well. This was my trajectory. I was actually working in learning how to build the muscle of corporate world and how to stay in lanes, but also be creative. And after the show was canceled, after one season of Here and Now, I was unemployed for 5 years. I couldn't get a job. I was a mess.
System, man. It's go tough. From the mountaintop to the latrine. Just like
exactly.
That.
I was with William Morris and I said, this is good. I'm 27, living in New York, writing on a sitcom. Everything's gold. I bartended for 5 years. How could this go bad? And since then, I was like, over the next 5 years, I was freelancing here and there. I pitched a show. I got an episode here and there, and friends were giving me some bones, so forth. Eventually, Best Damn Sports Show came around, and I knew the guy who helped create the show, a guy named Jeremiah Boskay, another very talented, very sweet guy. And he brought me on as one of the first two writers on Best Damn Sports Show. Me and Brian Keith Etheridge, I think, we were the first two hires. And then I brought in Josh and Jerry, because I had worked with Jerry, who hired me on Malcolm and Eddie. It was another Malcolm sitcom. So I've written on two Malcolm Jamal Warner sitcoms. How about that?
What's
that award? Great guy. Listen, everybody's great. Where was my train of thought? Anyways, I forgot where I was headed with the trajectory.
You brought in Jerry and Josh.
Yeah, brought Jerry and Josh in. So it was now, we were kind of a reunion of the Malcolm and Eddie days and the history we started, you know, shaping
that juggernaut,
the show.
That juggernaut exactly. Of the Malcolm and Eddie days. Eddie Griffin still around.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah, he just did there's a booker here who I tried to take under my wing a little bit, and he decided he didn't want my wing at all. But super nice guy. But he's been bringing all the kind of Hollywood has-beens in as stars here. And like Eddie Griffin came here. Andrew Dice Clay was just here. You know, all the guys, the Comedy Store guys who can't get work anywhere else. He doesn't understand what he's booking, so he brings them in.
But when we had Brian Keith Etheridge came in, and Brian has gone on to really great work now. He actually is creating shows and doing sitcoms. So I took him under my wing to show him how a script was actually formatted, how you write things, how you come up with an idea and so forth, because he was a stand-up and he was a very funny guy. Anyways, he honed his craft, and now look at him today. He's doing incredible. But after Best Damn Sports Show, it's like, you know, it was hit and miss. And I said, you know, I got a family. How can I, and I need work, and what can I do? And I knew a guy who knew a guy, and I got the job at the network, at Fox Network. It's a year and a half after Best Damn Sports Show ended, and working in promo and marketing. And I was able to use all my comedy writing skills and directing and producing skills to put that towards this Wild West called the internet.
What?
And Facebook. And little content pieces that can live there forever. It doesn't need to have a scheduling time. You can just drop it in and boom. So this was this was the Wild West that we actually started to hone and focus on. And I've been there since 2008. I'm now creator director, doing the same kind of work. Obviously it's morphed and it's changed throughout the years, but it's been job consistency. I don't get to write characters because the character's already written. Because if it's Family Guy, Peter Griffin's already done. But what can I do with the Peter Griffin bit? And another great thing about it is, like, you know, shows get canceled all the time. If I'm on a staff, and you know, it's like working on a 13-week contract. If it goes away, it goes away. Well, if a show goes away where I am, there's another one behind
it. Look at that. Hey, I'll work with these people.
Exactly. And no matter if the show sucks or not, yeah, I love it. You have to love it. You have to find the nugget that you can market it. And that is something that, you know, you got to take away. I don't like this show. It's no way. No, you love all the shows. And you put that all aside.
Well, that plays to your strengths, your ability to love mediocre things.
And my wife's strength. She loves a mediocre thing. So it's all good.
That's a superpower. It is a superpower, and not in a bad way. I totally mean this, though. Like, I've worked now for almost 7 years for businesses here in Austin, and you have to lower this idea of, like, in sort of creative entertainment and also in academics, it's always trying to create amazingness. Like, that's the whole game. Like, amazingness is what wins. The best thoughts over in academics, or the best, you know, stories and characters and jokes over in entertainment. And so that's a great bar, but it's not the bar for business. Like, maybe their product is great, you know, but what they really want in their messaging is just effective. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, oh, okay, I'm now in the box of effectiveness, not super creativity or super intellectualism. And I have to deliver in, you know, that's the strike zone. There it is right there in front. And you're like,
that's right.
They can't handle a ton of creativity. And they definitely can't handle a ton of intellectualism or controversy and stuff like that. So just throw the strike.
Well, that's a great analogy on the strike zone. And it is smaller for broadcasting. Even though you think broad, you have to appeal to the mass. So that's why a lot of the stuff you and I may not like, because it's not really right in our wheelhouse. We like the more stuff on FX or Netflix or what Prime's doing, because they could do anything. and they just give money to people just to let me know, I want your voice. You'll have very few network notes. And that's where you're getting a lot of interesting things like a Squid Game. So, I mean, I was obsessed with Squid Games, and I just finished it last night. It was just fantastic. And, you know, we were at the network thinking, look at all the water cooler talk about Squid Games. What could be done at our network with our shows? That's a great question. That's a really great question. And I want to crack that. Is it possible? That's what you can pay me. Let's see if we can crack. Let's see if we can make a water cooler thing from what we're doing. And that comes back to loving, you know, you have to love what you're given.
Well, I think you do a good job of walking those two lines of staying in the strike zone, but you always want to bring creativity into it. And you recognize what good creativity is. You see, you know, when it's got this kind of uranium in it, and you're like, we should get some of that uranium. And I know it's dangerous. I know it's radioactive and it kills people, you know, over time with degradation of cells, but just a little bit of it in there. It turns out it makes everything glow really cool.
That's right. And then you got to be the salesperson. You have to be able to show them if they don't see it, because it's all when somebody, and this is something I learned in Best Damn Sports Show. And this is one of the confidence things that I've actually over, I'm 57. I'm actually 57 in about a week. So thank you for the birthday greeting. I've learned to build up the muscle of that sucks. What you're writing there stinks. On Best Damn Sports Show, I can't tell how many times they said, that's not funny or that's stupid. And somebody in working in a creative world can really be affected by that. They can think that hurts. And I don't know how I can rebound from that, because you really, this is my heart I put on the page. For me, you tell me it sucks, okay, great. Here's another idea. It doesn't bother me because I worked on that muscle so much. So a lot of times when we're at in my world right now, marketing and promos, if they're pitching something and it doesn't go, or think, I don't think so, I just go, great, here's something else. And they're much more kind than they were at Fox Sports. They had the Bill Belichick views of saying no to comedy. Here it's like, I don't know about it. And then I always go back to, well, comedy is subjective. I think it's hilarious. You don't. You're above me. So let's move on. But you're not going to say it's not funny because I think it is. And that's the beautiful thing about subjectivity. It's in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, I have a lot of mantras that allow me to get through those systems. And I haven't had to do much of this lately, other than in business, where I never really try to do that much funny or because they can't handle it at all. There was a sprinkler company that came in, and you know, it's Texas, so they're constantly selling yards blank sprinkling systems and things like this all over. And they're like, we need something, you know, distinguish us, because there's so many of us here. And I'm like, okay, how about this, whatever their name was, we get you wet.
Great. I love it.
And they're like, I'm like, everybody will remember you. Like, the media will pick it up. It'll make it viral and everything else. They're like, we can't do that. And I'm like, okay. So you want viral boring. I got you.
Right.
I got
you. But then they know that line would make a splash. Welcome, Yay. Dan. Run with it. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, when you know in your heart of hearts that this is really going to work, but you see the fear in their eyes of like, gosh, how do I explain this away? I got to hold on my job. Let's play close to the vest and we'll find something else.
Yeah. The institutions and organizations by their nature have to be conservative, because if they make a mistake, it costs a lot. Costs people their jobs, costs a lot of, you know, blowback, all this stuff can ruin a product. I totally get why they're conservative. And so it becomes an art of getting, again, some kind of an interesting uranium dart in the middle of their stuff. So it's got a little energy and pep to it and will be liked.
Right.
So the conservatism doesn't just drown it all.
Right. What you should do next time is once you pitch something they don't like, you just write, I'm going to put it in my pilot and just start writing it down right in front of me. Got it. Okay. Boom. Thank you.
Yeah. I try to stay in their world, not my world, because they're paying me for, you know, to service their world. It's all good.
Yeah. You know, and that's, the pandemic has I wanted to be creative during this pandemic and also just be creative outside of Fox. And that's why I created this web series that actually I'm starring in with a good buddy of mine that I get to write, produce, direct, and edit myself. And it's just been such a great outlet for me to do what I want to do. Just like your podcast, you're not looking to promote it or you don't care if it blows up. It's just a great thing for you. That's what this thing does for me. And it still is. I'm still doing little episodes for it. And it's just such a joy. It could call it home. Movie,
I watched it.
Call
it's
it whatever
interesting.
You want.
Like, you know, here's what I want to know. It's such an odd way of editing. Like, what is up with the way you edit it? Because like the rhythm of it, you're clearly doing that on purpose. So tell me, what's the thought behind that?
I wanted to do just a Zoom call in a pandemic from these two buddies, best friends from life. And they never talk about the pandemic because there's so much happening in the relationship at all times. But I wanted to do a little heightened reality of it. I wanted to really be an absurdist version of this. Because if people see Zoom calls all the time, it's like, how can I ratchet it up? So I really went on the absurd side and unrealistic hyper-reality side. And that's been such a joy because I just throw anything against the wall. And it works. I mean, I think it's absurd and silly
you,
and it's
man.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned this, like, I think when you do full on creative products and you're like, I've serviced many, many different types of, you know, message needers in the world. And I've brought whatever I can to them. But if I'm just building something myself, and we talked about this before we started, like on my podcast, I don't allow comments anywhere. Not on my social media, not on my Substacks. I don't care what you think. And it's great if you love it. That's awesome. If I could just have just pure positivity, I might let people to comment. But even that warps you. You're like, oh, they love this. I'll write more of that. You don't want your creatives writing toward the feedback. You don't want
That's
censorship
right.
And you don't want, you know, pure love. Because I've seen pure love destroy comedians. Like a lot of comedians get to be where, you know, they walk in Seinfeld. This happened to Seinfeld. I've seen him a couple of times when I was still in LA go up and work on stuff. And I'm like, oh, he's had too much love. He doesn't now have an ear for what's good and what's not because everybody laughs at everything he says. And that will kill a comedian. So you don't want to do that to your creatives. That's first. And then second, I could care less about metrics. I don't want to live by metrics. I don't want to think about the numbers. You know, great.
Absolutely. I mean, no one's following this. I mean, the show is called, I haven't mentioned the title, it's called Love You, L-O-V-E, you. And if you search for, just put my name, Brian Kahn, Love You, and up will pop my pink thumbnails. But for those, it's like, no one's following it. It's not catching on like I thought it would. And I said, you know, like you're saying, it's like, fuck it, I'm just going to do it. And I'm doing some more really bizarre stuff coming up that actually takes these Zoom calls into a whole other area. Breaking news to you right now on it. I'm going to be turning my next phone conversation into a true crime podcast. That's going to be the Zoom call. It's going to have an air and all the tropes of a true crime podcast. And that's going to be the next of the 3-part series for Love You. And the guy who I'm doing it with is a very talented actor, dear friend of mine. By the way, this guy his name is Patrick Gallo. He is a playing the role of Mario Puzo in Paramount's Making of the Godfather series. So he got a huge role. So I'm very happy and proud for him. And hopefully that'll get us some more views.
You're so good about making connections to people. Like you have such a good network of people. There's something about you. And I've described you before as, like I said, the nicest guy in Hollywood, that there's nothing offensive about Khan. You know, and you're such a pleasant person to be around. You laugh so easily. You seem to have a joy about life. You network better than I think anybody I've ever seen.
You'd be surprised. I feel like I'm a terrible networker. I'm terrible at branding my own thing. And I'm really good at helping others. But for me, I feel like and this is my confidence level that I actually have. I've slowly have at 57. I'm now beyond that. It's like, I have more of it. I have more French inside me than I did ever. But I don't feel like I do that. I guess it's interesting to hear you say that because I don't think of that way. I am that way.
Well, I'll put it this way. Like, I don't think you're particularly somebody who likes to go out and network with just everybody in the world, like blindly in this kind of public, you know, everybody's my best buddy sense. Like I know a lot of people like that, and mostly actors and celebrities in Hollywood are that way. You know, that's how they got where they are, is they're just good at making people think they like them. And you're not that, but you're when you get to know you and you're working with you and stuff like that, that's where you excel. Like it's an authentic networking, you know,
and
you will do things for people and, you know,
And that's what you're saying. How did I stay at Best Damn the whole time? It's that. How have I been at Fox since 2008 and at Fox Broadcasting? It's that. I know the lane. I know how to make nice with people. And the people I work with are terrific. They're very kind and nice people. And I really enjoy working at the network, or I would have left a long time ago. It's just been very fulfilling.
That's such great, some great memories of, because Fox is such a toxic environment corporately, in my experience, when I was at Fox News, and just you could just see the stress and pressure on everybody outside of the comedy writers' cubicles. And we had this little hovel of 6 or 8 cubicles, and people had to walk through it to get things. I don't know if you remember this day, but it was the woman who was the comptroller or whatever who on Best Damn, and she had clearly had a very bad day. And she's walking through and she goes, I don't want to hear a goddamn thing from any comedy writers. If I hear one goddamn comment from any comedian, I'm going to fire people.
I remember that day very well. Yeah, it was, there were many lows. And we were like put in these cubicles like veal. And it was like, we really didn't have much to move around. We could go from our desk to our computer and then back. And now we're talking to the room. It was very tight. And what was, with regards to you, I've noticed that you were a sponge. And after listening to your podcast and seeing where your trajectory is, in my mind, I look at you as the Jane Goodall of comedy. You like to get in. We were the gorillas in your midst. How about that?
Hey.
Boom. But you looked at the coterie of comics and you were trying to figure us out, and you were trying to do the Rubik's Cube of not only how this works, but also how you look at comics even today. And when I hear you on your podcast and you're talking about how you guide comics and how you can, and I understand it because you're Jane Goodall. You've actually studied them. You know the tropes. You know that this guy is here's the Midwestern comic from Chicago. He likes to migrate south to go to these clubs. Here's the New York Jew from the Upper West Side. He does these cerebral jokes over there. But that has been your brand of like, and that you can get in with these gorillas because you're one of them. You are a comic, you're a writer, and you're a performer. So it's like they let you into the world, and you have this kind of very cool, you can blend in.
That's a good one. I like it. I'm the gorilla in the gorillas in the mist. Just another gorilla.
You're the gorilla? Okay.
For some reason, this gorilla is taking notes, but you know, it's just another gorilla.
Oh, no, you're the good all. You're good all.
But that's kind of, I guess, because I do run both games. I run the intellectual game, and I did that for a long time. And I was a stand-up at the same time as a professor. So I have all this training about looking at the world and trying to organize it into thoughts and, you know, teachable systems. But then like just comedy, like there's nothing. And this is probably what I miss more than anything about Hollywood and being on staff with other comedy writers and stuff. And just like you were great to go harass, like to just drop in when you were working and start telling you jokes to make you laugh. Right. Oshak was terrible because he was the Unijoker. He would pull his hoodie on, his headphones, and you couldn't disturb him. I would go and do it anyway. I would sit there in his office and just stare at him. But you were like, it was so much fun to drop jokes on you, jokes that I knew wouldn't get on the show. But I'm like, I'm gonna throw this to Khan anyway. And I miss that ability to just be in a comic, you know, comedy drenched environment, and it'd be totally fine to say whatever you want, whenever, however odd. That's the game. That's the fun of it, you know. And that doesn't exist anywhere else.
No, and I wonder how that would play today with in this world, in this climate that we're in, because we were in a very small small large trailer, and there were like probably 30 to 50 cubicles, so everyone was hearing everybody else, and so things that came out of our mouths today may not be accepted as they were those years ago.
Yeah, you can't really break open the Rubik's, the cube of comedy writing doesn't play well with the rest of civilization.
Right.
You know, the rules aren't the same. You're in the comedy cube, which means you can say the most awful things as long as they're constructed correctly within comedy and funny, because people know you don't mean it, you know? And
that's,
I tell people, I've had this argument a million times. I'm like, comedy doesn't play by the rules of civilization. It's not the same thing. Like, if you want to know my real feelings about social issues and people and all that, you want to discover my fatal flaws and my villainy, then come on, we'll go talk. And you can tell me what you think it is. But don't judge my comedy and say, that's what you really think. Like, because no, it's not. That's me finding a joke.
That's right. That's right. Working at the network, I have to write PG jokes or G-rated jokes. Anything that we, for example, like, you know, at Hell's Kitchen being a Gordon Ramsay show, we couldn't say the word hell in a sketch or in a promo because it's, you can't, but the show's called Hell's Kitchen. There were so many restrictions. So you get good at knowing where to do things. I was the writer producer for promo marketing for Glee back in the day. And I came up with this web series for the show that starred Jane Lynch. And it was with T-Mobile, and it was that integration where actually with the bit was one of the cheerleaders, they were spying on the other Glee kids with their T-Mobile phone, and there's your integration. And she would then show Sue Sylvester, Jane Lynch's character, the footage that she captured, and then we roll show footage of the clips of the thing. But I got to write 5 episodes and work closely with and direct Jane Lynch. And that was
fun.
And that's like, it was incredible. I mean, she was so, to hear your words come out of an A-lister, that is just the best thing in the world. And to give it, I gave her a directing note, and she took the directing note to the T. And as I said, God, that was the wrong note to give. I said, Jane, I really am sorry. I gave you really bad direction and you took it perfectly. So here, let's try it this way instead. But she was amazing in that she tested me at one point. She said, give me 3 areas to do here, 3 jokes. So I said, okay, great. Yeah. So then I went off to the side and I said, fuck, okay, now the time's ticking. And you know, when that light goes on, you have to. So I came up with ideas. I pitched her 3 jokes. She said, I like this one. So great. We did it. Boom. At the end of the day, she came up to me. She said, I'm doing this new show and I'm looking for jokes. Would you be? I said, yes, yes. Whatever you're going to say. Yes. And I was able to write some jokes for this Hollywood Game Night. It was the first episode. And she asked me to come up with some things. And I did. I sent it to her. And I think she used one of them in the show. And that's as far as it went. And if she walked past me in the street, she wouldn't know who I was. But that moment, I was thinking, maybe this is it. Maybe this is my next step into the next.
So many moments. So many moments.
Yeah.
It's, I enjoyed working in Hollywood. I moved to Austin because of my kids. And that was fine. You know, I've lived here and raised kids and it's been great. I enjoyed LA and Austin or Hollywood for its craziness. And I didn't mind even the fact that it was constantly, you know, trap doors opening underneath you and things that could make a ton of money and do so good for you. And they just died. You know, like, I'm going up these stairs. Oh, there's no more stairs. Look at that. It's just the nature of the game. You know, if I'd have started in it earlier, I would have stayed in it, you know, and you just get used to it. That is the culture. And you come up with theories like approaches like you have of, hey, I can survive here by doing really good work for people and staying in this particular lane. And yeah, I have other creative desires and I'll service those on my own outside of this. Some people can't do that. They cannot, you know, subvert what they want to do, that prime directive. Like, I'm just doing this no matter what. And I remember Galifianakis and I had the same manager for a while. And Galifianakis was never going to change anything. Like, he's like, this is what I do.
Right.
You know,
That's amazing. I mean, like you're saying, you try to find those cracks in the wall that you could do your own thing in your own voice. And then you do this. You could do that. Boom. I become a Fox guy. How about that background, Ben?
Hey, cool. Look at that.
This is my Zoom background at work.
Yeah.
Only you get to see this.
I miss the tech power of working for Fox Studios. Like just going up and, you know, you have this idea and then you walk in and you get these great producers and they shoot it and you have actors and everybody helping out. And then you take it into the Avid suite and they just bang, 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 bang. And you got all these resources to throw on it, music and free.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
That's a joy.
That production capacity.
Totally. 3 times a year, I get to write and produce the half hour special for the affiliates. It's basically a half hour promo of all of our new shows. And we have the talent from the shows come and talk about their shows, and they tee up to the first look package. So we're doing our next one. I've done like 12 of them or so. I'm doing the next one. It's called the Winter Preview, Fox, the 2022 Fox Winter Preview. And we're filming it the next couple of weeks, and it's the holiday theme and so forth. We're having all these stars. But it's like, is Rob Lowe available? Can we get Rob Lowe for this? Oh, he's not. Okay, let's see if Nick Offerman's available. And it's like, how lovely is that?
Right. Yeah, and they all say yes. They have to, you know, basically say yes because it's the
to a point,
they're
yes,
selling
they do.
Their show that they're going to make a lot of money on if it stays on the air.
That's right. Now, as for Dan's show, how's Dan's show going to stay on the air? I have an idea for you, Dan, and I should have teased this up top because the viewers have probably already checked out by now. Right now, it's only my mom watching. So, Mom, I hope you enjoy this. But I think Dan's missing one thing.
What's that?
And that's a
monkey?
A theme song. A monkey and a theme song, okay? Because it starts off very, I'm Dan, and ends, goodbye.
I don't do bumpers. Dan, I don't produce shit. It's just talk, baby. But if you got one.
Well, hear what you got. I have written for you a theme song. All right? Now, this is for you. It's an ASCAP free. No publishing needed. It's needle drop, baby.
All right.
Here we go. There we go. Let's see what I got for you, right? Here we go. Dan French. Rhetoric. Bald. Warrior. Dan French, rhetoric warrior. Hope you enjoyed that, Danny.
That was awesome. It's been a while since I've heard, you know, an original Brian Kahn bit, and I've missed them horribly.
Horribly is the perfect word. Thank you.
That was great. Like I said, I remember going to the play that you wrote. I went with Oshak and I think Josh
and Jerry.
I think it was in Burbank, right?
I can't believe you remember that.
And I just remember watching this and just thinking, you know, like I always want such good things for you because you're working so hard. And you're creating things that I think are interesting. Like, I'm like, oh, this is a viable play. Look at that. And you got real, like, you have real actors in it. You had that guy from Breaking.
I had Paul Dooley, who's, you know, huge. And I had Uncle Leo from Seinfeld, you know, who played Uncle Leo.
Yeah, you were, I mean, how'd you get those people? Like, you network everything. And I'm like, this is, you know, this is fun. It's just fun to see you put that together.
Thank you. I totally forgot about that play that I did. It's like, it was once again, trying to always expand and put things out there. And most often than not, it's going to fail. It's not going to go anywhere. But what else am I going to do? I mean, I have to do something. So why not?
What else am I going to do? So funny. I remember one of my favorite memories of that play was afterwards. We're all standing around. We're talking to you. And the woman who played the nurse, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember her name, but she was a large black woman, and she walked up and she's like, thank you. And you're like, oh God, that was great. You know? And before she left, she goes, next time, give me more to do. Give me more. You could just, she's like, I could act, and you knew she could. And I'm like, yeah.
Oh, that's right. She was saying, you're just totally opening up some mind doors in my head about that night. It was just a stage reading. It was like, the first time I actually heard it out loud, maybe the second time. And I did it a second time after that with a different, I brought in some new cast members, and Paul and Len were still the same. It was just, I'm just trying to figure it out. And, you know, I needed to rewrite it another 100 times before it actually got to be any good. So you heard, God bless, I remember that you, Dan, and you were with Jerry and Josh, and you were standing there, and I knew it. There was a lot of great moments, but it wasn't a great play. I knew it needed a lot of work. And I looked in your eyes, and I, once again, Dan being the Jane Goodall, you look at him and you see what he sees, and you see that there's problems with it, and there should be, because it's just a fucking reading. It's a stage reading. It's the first time we're hearing it. And you said, Con, we should talk. And that's all you said. We should talk. Because you had notes. And I was like, great. Would love to hear what you have to say. But you were just so giving in that, I have some thoughts. I think I can help. And that was awesome. Well, we never talked about it, but it was on.
Did we? No. I always look at it like, again, the things I love about Los Angeles is that it's one of those places that's driven by hope, often irrational hope, but who cares? But it's people creating, constantly creating. And my thing is always the what it's missing so often is that second level, you know, from the first iteration to the 99th iteration where it will be good, it falls apart in the middle of that. But it just needs love. It needs development. It needs people jumping in, giving you more, because those things are, there's so much going on in any type of full product, any type of full, you know, project that you do, production that you do, that it needs help. And I've seen this a lot in Austin. There's a little production company here run by four guys who I like very much. And they managed to get a movie done and produced, and had two or three SNL people on it. And I think, I can't remember who distributed, but it was a real distributor. But they showed me the script early on, and I really liked the writer, as a young guy. And I'm like, yeah, it's 20% there, man. You know, you need to take it through the development process. And I think you drained your battery on it, you know, and I think you got it to here. You need to go find some comedy writers and some other narrative writers to do the next 10 drafts. And he just looked at me like I just, you know, sentenced him to the execution chamber, and how dare I?
Like, yeah.
But that's what makes things good, is all that energy, all that talent coming to bear on it.
I mentor through my San Diego State. And I always tell my mentees, if they're writers, I say, listen to my notes. And if they resonate, run with it. If they don't, you're the voice, you're writing this, then don't take it. So, but be open to notes. Ultimately, you're the decider, and I'm not going to force your hand to do something that you don't believe in. So this person you talked to, and you said 20% there, and if he's reticent or is saying F you, I'm not interested, no way, it sounds like a lot of work, it's like, it's a lost cause. You know, it's like, I'm glad you're not wasting your time, because, you know, it's like, there's going to be like arms folded. It's like, defensive. Yeah.
Well, this is where you and I always like split. Like, I think that's probably the humane way of doing it, which is, yes, you are the decider. Take my notes or don't. See you later. It's all good. And as a rhetorician and as somebody who likes things really good and doesn't like to watch people fail, unnecessarily fail, I've gone over the years, been like, here's the deal. You know, this is what needs to be done. You don't have to follow my notes perfectly, but here's where all the flaws are.
Right.
And you either fix those or put out a product that's going to fail. And if you want to do that, then realize what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then don't bitch at the end when people don't like it.
Yes.
You know, and so like I hate to leave people in their humane, I'm the auteur. I'm the artiste. I'm like, no, you're not. You're 20%, which is great.
That's smart. I mean, if you're going to go to Dan French for something, you know that he's going to lead you in a certain way. So go on that ride, take that train with him and listen to him and do that. And especially if you align with that person creatively. Absolutely.
Well, I think there's humane, but development is the concept. And that is, I've held onto that for so long because I know the power of it in stand up. If you understand development, then like stand-ups will have an idea and you go up and it's this cheat. They've got the cheat system of being able to do it with a live audience in an unimportant setting and get feedback. The audience is literally this super active editor that tells you every joke, every word, every phrase is bad or good. Yeah. And they're merciless. There is no bending. They will tell you instantly that's not good. Fix it before you bring it back here.
Yeah.
And you can't ignore it in stand up because those silences will get you not paid and, you know, will make you fail. And so it's this beautiful system where they can't argue. And I used to have, I would do comedy workshops before open mic nights, and somebody would run, they would run bits, and I'd try to help them avoid their problems or whatever. And I'd be like, don't do this, this, and this, because it's going to fail, or, you know, whatever. And they'd be like, but I like it. I'm like, well, go ahead. And then they would go up and just fail. And they would come back to me like whip dogs.
I told you so. Well, once again, you're the Jane Goodall of comedy. You have read the room. you can see the room, and that's the seer that you're offering to generously. I'm glad that you're making some money on this or on occasion, because it's certainly guidance, and I hope that people have an ego enough to actually to divorce it and bring in what you're saying. I have a little idea in my, I have written jokes for stand-up. I always wanted to try stand-up, and I said, if I ever get this down, I'm going to hire Dan to take me through this, because I don't know what the hell I'm doing, and I've done improv for a long time, but that's totally different. And stand-up is just, I have this kind of little itch, and maybe down the road.
You're only 57. You know, why push it? Why? You
know. Exactly. By the way, you gave me a thought on something where you want to get things right, even if it's after. I remember back in the day, Norman Lear, let's say one of his shows, Good Times. It was an episode. He edited it. It aired that week, and he still had a problem with one of those moments. So he then went back to the edit bay, and he re-edited the episode, and it already failed. I mean, it's already out in the ether. It's gone. But for his own sake, he had to have it, get it right. And there's something really wonderful about that.
Yeah, I totally get it. I get it. Like, there's a story from literature with Raymond Chandler, wrote The Big Sleep, you know, basically invented the detective novel in a lot of ways. And he said, somebody asked him, do you ever go back and read your books? And he's like, no, because it's torture. I see everything that's wrong. Because yes. I hate doing that to myself because I can't edit it now. And
right.
And I'm that kind of hyper editor. I love development. I will go through a script a million times and then let somebody else come in, and they'll all suddenly, you know, open up the break open the rainbow. And you're like, oh, I didn't see all these colors. Look at all that.
Yeah.
You know? And when you get that, when you get like a creative entity that will work on something with you, that's where you get these. Like Fleabag, I don't know if you're a big fan of Fleabag or not, but I love it because of the way it created blended pathos and comedy like very few things ever have. But watching her stage show of it and watching her, and the jokes are all there and a lot of the acting is there, but whoever she brought in to direct that is like responsible for at least 50% of the success of that thing.
I agree.
It is so well directed. The timing is so perfect. The stings, the music, the takes, just amazing.
It's the tribe. And I, at my at 57, I'm trying to put myself around people to build my tribe of people that I can rely on and just to make me look better. And that is so key. And even though the ego says, it's all me, it's my voice, and I'm the guy, and it ends with me. No, try to get your Dan Frenches and your Paul Dooleys and all the people that you can try to bring into your corral and just put on a show.
Well, I remember when I sold my old stand-up show to another comic who I'd worked with for a long time, and he was still out doing stand-up, and I was writing full-time in TV, so I wasn't going to do that stuff, and it was a Southern-oriented show. But I went around with him for a while writing some new material with him, and he would go up and do my material that I'd done for off and on for 10 years or more in the South as a headlining comic, but he would get standing ovations with it. And I remember walking around in Huntington, West Virginia at a 2-story Funny Bone, and I was up in the balcony and he was running a new bit I'd just written the day before at the gym. Like, I just realized that people needed nude rules at the gym, like dudes. Like, don't walk up to me and start talking to me about football without a towel. I don't care what you have to say. You can tell me the inside line about whatever. But, so it's a long bit. It's like 6-7 minutes. And he was doing it for the first time. And it was just crushing.
Yeah,
it was devastating the room. And I'm walking around behind them just listening to the laughs. I could care less if it was me. I wouldn't have got that level of laughter.
Yes, yes. That joy, I totally understand it. It's like it came from you. This is you're responsible for this. And look at the reaction. That is a gift. That's a joy. I understand that. That's great.
It has been a joy. I'll segue. It's been a joy talking to Brian Kahn.
Dan, so fun. I'm so glad you. I was worried. It's like, is he going to talk to me for an hour? I haven't talked to anybody that long in my life. How's this going to happen? And here we are.
We got plenty more. There's plenty more. I'll come back around sometime. We'll have another conversation because
I have a list.
You had a very interesting career. I think, you know, for a guy who started here, like the NBC stuff and the fact that you've merged creative and promotion within entertainment. That's an interesting career you got there.
It's a trajectory I did not think. I thought I was going to be the next Spielberg and Scorsese when I got out of college. And now look at me, I'm doing a promos and marketing. I never would have thought.
Yeah, but look how many shitty movies they made too. So you avoided that. You avoided Silence or Quiet or whatever that thing was Scorsese made, an unwatchable movie.
Dan, thanks for having me on. You're a delight, and it's so great catching up with you.
Yes, we will circle back around. And everybody, this is Brian Kahn. Everybody should know Brian Kahn. You've seen his stuff. You watch Fox because of him, because he knows how to sell Fox to you. And super fun. We'll circle back around. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out, persuade. People need it. See ya.